Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 101, Rebecca Romney.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astrologer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
And we are just back from our 100th episode, and boy, are our arms tired.
Boy, is my jaw tired from all
is that
flapping.
I don't know. I've been running around the neighborhood trying to catch these little Pokemon. As I've been listening to the latest episode, and they're stubborn little buggers.
Oh, are they really?
Yeah. It seems to be all the rage. Pokemon Go this, Pokemon Go that. A lot of people have just taken it upon themselves to say, Pokemon No. The latest craze with the handheld devices out there, augmented reality.
Well,
we hope to augment your reality.
And
today.
Without that annoying headset.
I know. Well, you kind of need that for us.
Oh, that's true. You do need
that. I'm talking about the
earphones.
The earphones. Now, augmented reality is different from virtual reality.
Well, of course. Okay,
the slight difference between the two. Virtual reality is the headset that you, as you said, the headset that you put over your eyes. Right. It basically isolates you from the rest of the world, and you experience a virtual world, where you are immersed in a situation, and you feel as if you are wherever the screen shows you to be. With augmented reality, you open your phone up, and it's connected to your camera app, and you will see things that populate on the picture that your phone is taking. So say you're taking a picture of your house, for example, and there may be things that are in and around your house that are not actually there, but they're just showing an augmented reality. There's all sorts of possibilities for storytelling, for outdoor exploration. One of the things I do like, as I've heard about Pokemon becoming very popular, is that it's getting people up and out of the house, interacting with each other, teaming up, conversing. It seems to be the antithesis of virtual reality, which isolates people with these ridiculous headsets and keeps them locked in basements.
But I don't understand how I can fit into that, because when I look at my house, I see things that no one else can see too. And I don't even have a phone!
That's why I like to keep things locked in the basement.
Yes. See, we're all, this is just another derivation of Elwood P. Dowd, you know, Harvey, you know, his friend the White Rabbit.
Right.
Yeah.
No, Harvey is now an augmented reality app.
Yeah, well, he's always been an augmented part of my reality, yeah.
I'll always love a dog named Bo.
Always love, yeah.
Did you ever see?
Yes, the poem, that he read. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. It wasn't a dry eye in the house after that.
There was a lovely line that I always remember from the film. I guess it's from the play, and certainly in the film. Harvey, in which a psychiatrist is asking Elwood Dowd whether or not there was anyone in his life. You know, was your father's name Harvey? Was perhaps an uncle, some relative you loved? Did you ever know anyone with that name? And he thinks for a moment. He says, no, I never knew anyone named Harvey, doctor. Perhaps that's why I had such high hopes for him.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, you can't spell Harvey without AR.
No. Oh, very good.
Augmented reality.
Augmented reality. Yes.
That's it. Ooh. Well, we would like to augment your reality today with another fine show. We'll be getting with our guest, Rebecca Romney, momentarily. But in the meantime, we'd like to pause for a bit of business.
Friends, everyone knows that Alfred the Great, king of the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex, defeated the great Viking army at the Battle of Edington in 876. But did you realize that you can salute the 1,140th anniversary of that noble victory with a visit to WessexPress.com? There you'll find the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, the original, exhaustively annotated 10-volume edition of the Sherlock Holmes stories by Edgar Award winner Leslie S. Klinger, the most complete collection of Sherlockian scholarship and commentary ever assembled. Each illustrated volume bursts with scholarly annotations and features a sturdy signature-sewn softcover binding. Friends, the clouds are high and massive, and there's only the sound of your looking at the lake. On this summer day, pass the time by reaching for the pleasure only a volume from the Wessex Press can provide. Choose yours today.
All right. Well, now that we've done our business, why don't we? I can't say
hello.
That face. Hi. Let's get over to Rebecca.
Yes.
Well, we are delighted to welcome Rebecca Romney to the program today. Rebecca is a rare book dealer for Honey and Wax Booksellers. And she says that as a brazen youth, she rebelled against her family of scientists by pursuing a degree in linguistics and classics. Oh, a gal after my own heart. After a year of teaching English in Japan, Rebecca was hired by Bauman Rare Books in 2007 to help launch their Las Vegas gallery. And there she sold rare books ranging from $50 to $500,000, including some first editions of The Hound of the Baskervilles, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes and more. And she began managing their gallery in 2010. And a year later, and this is the cool part, folks, she started appearing regularly as the rare book specialist on History Channel's TV show Pawn Stars. And just to prove that what happens in Vegas does not necessarily stay in Vegas, in 2014, Rebecca moved to the East Coast to manage the central operations of Bauman Rare Books. And since then, she struck out on her own, hosting a podcast, which we absolutely want to talk to her about, called Biblioclast. And she partnered with Honey and Wax Booksellers for selling rare books. Rebecca and her husband have just completed a book called Printer's Error, Irreverent Stories from Book History, which will be published by HarperCollins in early 2017. And one of her latest publications, and one of the reasons, one of the many reasons we want to talk to her, can be found in the Baker Street Journal's Winter 2015 issue titled The Skeptic's Guide to Sherlock Holmes. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm quite pleased to be here. Bert laughs at that.
Well,
what, you're pleased?
That's not going to last.
That'll wear off after about 20 minutes.
Yes, it's still the first blush. Yes.
Get me out of here. So as we ask all of our guests, how did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
How did I first meet Sherlock Holmes? You know, Sherlock Holmes is always in the air. I think it's everyone has a general sense of him. The first writings, anything I actually read by the first thing I read about Sherlock Holmes was probably The Hound of the Baskervilles. I think that that was the one that, that stuck out in my mind the most. I have an inclination towards gothic tales. And so I ended up picking that one up. And it's funny because I think I can tell you the precise moment when I fell in love with that book. Because right in the beginning, there's this line, James Mortimer, and he is admiring Sherlock Holmes's skull. If you remember this. And he has this line, he says, "It is not my intention to be fulsome, but I confess that I covet your skull." And I knew in that moment that I was going to enjoy this book. So that that's the first encounter that I really remember sitting down and having Sherlock Holmes like really make an impression on my mind.
How old were you?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Probably high school. High school. It was before college. And then in college, you know, I came back and I'd, you know, read certain short stories. You always see things like Speckled Ben. And of course, I read Scandal in Bohemia. And they appeared on my radar. And it wasn't actually until I hooked up with Bowman Rare Books and I started selling the first editions that I went through more systematically. And I was like, if I'm selling these books, maybe I should know about them. And I read Sign of the Four, and I read Study in Scarlet, and I went through all of the different short stories. And the adventures and memoirs are just so fun to sell because everyone has their own story that is their favorite, and you can get into arguments with people. Generally in a sales environment, not the best idea to argue, but sometimes you can't help yourself. So that's kind of how I got my first critical look, is I started looking into the first editions. I had memorized a lot of the bibliographic points. I had to really know them from more of the physical collecting aspect.
Before you got into the commercial side of the book business and rare first editions and the marketing and sale of these things, when you were a kid, were you – well, obviously, you must have grown up in a house with lots of books, and you must have been a big reader.
Yes. I was a big reader. My scientist family, they're also big readers. They did a lot of science fiction reading, as you can imagine. My father, though, he would read Dostoevsky as well as, you know, H.G. Wells and that type of thing. And I had two older brothers who were big readers. And it's funny because from a very young age, I was taught to be careful with how I handled books because I'm just this little kid, and my oldest brother's 5 years older than me, and I would always want to borrow his books. But of course, because I was so much younger, I would return them not in exactly the same condition. And so from about the age of 8 or so, he gave me very strict instructions about how much I could open them, you know, how far in order to keep wear from the spine. And so I've always kind of had this itch in my back of my mind when it comes to condition and handling of books. Maybe that was like starting me on my rare book career earlier than I expected.
And were you a collector when you were a kid? Did you?
Oh, I collected things, not books. I mean, you know, I don't know. You either have a collecting mindset or you don't. Either get it or you're just like, why are you hoarding all of these things? And for me, yes, I had different collections of things. You know, I went through periods where you do rock collections and the like. I'm trying to think if I actually collected any books. I don't think that happened until I hooked up with Bowman, and that was a mistake. Like, you do not want to collect when you are a rare bookseller because that means you don't get a paycheck.
Right.
So I generally try not to collect, honestly. I try to get more of a vicarious pleasure through placing books in collections. That's actually a really satisfying thing about being a dealer, is that you find something and you know it's perfect for someone, and there's this glee of, you know, you're going to contact them and say, ah, you are going to love this. That's something that's a little addictive because you do get that same thrill of the hunt and through the satisfaction of knowing that that book's going to a good place. That is not my own, right?
So there are no things that you collect for yourself or passions you have in books?
I mean, I shouldn't.
Just between us.
That's the thing, I shouldn't.
Tell anybody.
But this is my problem, is whenever I'm doing research, I'm looking for buying books, inevitably I see books that I want to buy for myself, and it's a problem. Collectors aren't necessarily very good with that thing called self-control, and I'm no exception. So
what do you enjoy reading just on your own? If you're not collecting, what are you reading?
What's on your nightstand? Yeah.
Let's see. What's on my nightstand?
Hey, that's personal, Bert.
There's a pile of books, actually. I tend to jump from book to book. I'm not one of those who waits and finishes an entire book before I start on another. And I tend to have at least one book of fiction, at least one book of nonfiction, and a book of poetry going all at the same time. Mm. You do that, right? That's totally normal, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of odd things in my... on my nightstand, things that are completely unrelated, you know.
Yeah, we're not going there, right?
Yeah.
No.
I have trouble finishing an issue of The New Yorker.
That's more of an aspirational read. No.
Yeah, yes, I have the feeling that they deliver The New Yorker daily in my house. I have a stack of them.
Yeah, those are the ones that you want to say that you read but don't generally get around to. I have plenty of those. Actually, one book that I have been loving lately that I think Sherlockians would be into is a book called The Scholar Adventurers. Altick, I think it's Richard Altick. He was a mid-century historian, and it's a collection of tales about great discoveries by historical researchers. So it talks about how we found out that Thomas Malory, who wrote the Morte d'Arthur, the great Arthurian cycle in English, was actually a knight prisoner who allegedly committed like pillage, rape, murder, etc. Was in jail while he was composing this. This was a 20th century revelation.
Wow.
Yeah. So The Scholar Adventurers, I completely recommend it. It's a great book. Altick is quite a storyteller, and it's just full of those types of anecdotes. There's another in there about discovering James Boswell's papers, including the original manuscript for his Life of Johnson. It dispels that notion that it's only dusty, boring reading that historians do. Actually, there's a lot of that too, but there also can be great revelations.
You must be familiar with the book, and it's probably a good 10 or 15 years old at this point, The Professor and the Madman.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. About the origins of book. EOD, yeah.
Yeah, was that Simon Winchester? Great book.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I like him. Mm-hmm.
So how did you get from teaching English in Japan to selling rare books?
Accident?
Yeah.
We'll say serendipity. How about that? That sounds fancier. So what happened was I had finished my bachelor's degree, and as you mentioned in the bio, I had a degree in linguistics, and my non-Indo-European language was Japanese. So I go to Japan kind of to cement the language, and when I came back, it was awkward timing to immediately go into graduate school as far as the application deadlines. So I thought, all right, I'm going to go to where my parents live in Vegas, kind of a home base, and I'll hang out there and I'll get a job until I go to grad school. And that was when Bowman was looking for people to open up their Vegas gallery. And I thought, oh, that sounds like fun. Maybe I'll do that. I had no idea what it would turn into. And it was just a few months in that I realized, nope, no, this is really what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life. I can tell.
Well, that's fantastic, though. You know, some people don't fall into that until midlife. I mean.
Yes. It was very much, I like to quote Seneca with this. It's his version of luck, which is preparation meets opportunity. I was very, very lucky that I was in the right place at the right time with the right background.
I love it. Chance favors the trained mind is another way of saying
it. Yes. I have many random quotes about luck. The other one I like is Thomas Jefferson. He says, you know, somehow the harder I work, the more luck that I have.
There you go. And on the flip side, with regard to success, you know, P.G. Wodehouse probably had one of the best quotes about success. And that is, the usual drawback to success is that it annoys one's friends so.
Is that a drawback, though?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's a drawback.
I like your thinking.
The unexplored benefit of success is that it annoys one's friends.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. Among my friends, the only major sin is being boring. So if you're annoying, that's fine, as long as you're not boring.
So when you're in this industry, and you mentioned how you were familiarizing yourself with the Holmes canon,
mm-hmm.
all the bibliographic variants and whatnot.
Yes.
I mean, That's just one author and one particular niche of what he wrote. How can you possibly have an encyclopedic knowledge of everything you're expected to source or sell?
Well, first, I don't. I mean, there's a lot of information I know off the cuff just from study and research and drilling it over and over and over again. I mean, it was a very, very steep learning curve. I remember during training, it was, for me at least, I was spending 12-hour days going to training and then coming home and just studying the material. And I would memorize whole lists of bibliographic points. You know, what's the point for Catcher in the Rye? What's the point for To Kill a Mockingbird? You know, what's the first issue? There are three main points for the first issue of Huckleberry Finn. And so you get to the point where you can kind of do that. And then what happens is that it sort of sticks in your mind, because working in a gallery in Las Vegas, as opposed to, say, the gallery we had in New York, you're getting people who are coming in who've never even heard of such a thing. They have a lot of different questions, and you get to introduce people all day long. So you're sort of rehearsing all of those basics, and they stick in your mind, and you just build from there. The really, really exciting thing about being in the rare book world is that you meet someone, and there's something that they're really enthusiastic about. And you don't even have to be enthusiastic about it, but you have to appreciate their enthusiasm. I remember early on, I met a man who was a dermatologist, and he wanted to create a collection of books about skin diseases. And I loved this because it gave me the opportunity to dig into a field I didn't know anything about. It. I had to learn all about the major names like Robert Willen and like Ali Bear. And I go in, and I remember getting these huge atlases, like color pictorial atlases of skin diseases, of different diseases in really advanced stages, so that the symptoms are terrible. And I would bring them in, and he would be so excited, and he'd look at me and say, "This is art." And I just was blown away by that. I just loved it. And so that's one of the opportunities I love about the job, is that someone comes in and it allows you to explore something with someone who's passionate about the subject. I mean, we're really never shy in that community about enjoying the fact that other people have things that they care about.
And when you're working in Vegas, I have to imagine you see quite a variety of humanity pass through that city.
We do, yes. I've had some of the oddest conversations. I remember once in the back of my head thinking, is this really happening? When a man came in and he was wearing a shirt that was entirely covered in an American flag pattern. And then he had one of those like beer hat things on that feeds into you. And then he had another necklace on that was an American flag that was flashing red, white, and blue. And he was talking to me about the Shakespeare authorship question.
Oh,
about, like, he was a Baconian.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, is this really happening?
Wow.
It's a Baconian and a lettuce and tomato one, too.
Yeah. It was amazing. Well, he probably was those things as well.
Yeah. For a minute, I thought you were going to say it was that doctor that was interested in skin diseases walking with a jacket made out of human skin.
No, I mean, you do meet a lot of characters, and the collecting world, of course, is full of characters, but in Vegas in general, it's just full of it. You'd be walking down I'd maybe be going out to lunch or something, and I'm in the Palazzo, and you just see someone carrying on their shoulder a fishbowl full of bright blue, like neon booze. Just walking through the casino.
Yeah. It's how the other half lives.
Right. So you get both in Vegas. That was a very interesting experience.
So you talked about the preparation and the training necessary for preparing yourself to get to this point. But what does an official training program about look like? I mean, are you in class every day? Are you following a preceptor or someone who's acting in a mentor type role? I mean, is it one-on-one?
All of the above. Well, for us, it was a little bit different because they were opening up the new gallery and preparing a group of us for opening the gallery. Normally, what would happen is they already had the established New York gallery, and if someone ended up leaving or something happened where they need to bring someone else new on, it would just be one person and they could kind of be folded in. But in Vegas, they really did sit us down. We had sessions where we went through all of the basics. You know, one of the first things that you would want to do, Bowman or not, just if you're in the rare book or collecting world, is get a hold of John Carter's ABC for Book Collectors, which is a sort of dictionary of all the terms that are used in book collecting, because you can get lost very quickly if you don't know what an octavo is and what decalages are and goffering and Morocco and all of that. So we had quizzes. We even had quizzes during the interview process. We had pop quizzes and essays and the whole bit. It was very much like returning to school. David Bowman, one of the founders, he would always kind of, in anticipation of how people were going to react, he'd emphasize that the training process really took years and it was more like receiving an advanced degree. Like, it wasn't until about 3 to 5 years of doing it that you really got a handle on it. And I remember at the time thinking, nah, I'm just going to study really hard and it's going to take me just a couple years. But he was right, because a lot of it's experience. Different people ask different questions when they come in. And, you know, the answer if you don't know something is, I don't know it, but I can find it out for you. And that's how you learn. And it does. It's this really exciting journey of discovery.
So it really sounds like, you know, even though you were intent initially on going to graduate school, And you said you fell into this career. It really sounds like it answered that need for graduate school in terms of additional learning, lifelong learning, become
yes.
a scholar of something. It really has answered both needs for you, having a career and furthering your education.
Yes, I think if you're going to be in the rare book trade, you do have to have an academic turn of mind, because there's a lot of sort of minutiae and research that you have to get into. And on the other hand, one thing that's tricky about it is you have to be a very social person too. I mean, you can't be in a gallery in Las Vegas and talk with walk-in traffic all day about, you know, their favorite books unless you enjoy interactions with human beings, which sounds funny, but most of us introverts struggle with that. So you do have to have kind of a dual personality of introvert, extrovert.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you first discover, after getting yourself familiar with the stories, that there were a whole group of strange people out there called Sherlockians doing this kind of thing? Was it somebody that walked into the store and that's how you were exposed to it, or did you find out some other way?
You'll get a kick out of this. The reason I learned about the community is because a Sherlockian corrected me. And in a public post I did, I'm going to name drop, because he loves it. He loves mentioning this story about how he had to go in and fix my error for me. I had done a blog post about studying Scarlet for Bowman, and Jerry Marglin, you've had on the show. So you guys knew immediately. I love that.
Oh my God. Episode 16.
That's right. Here it comes. So, dear Jerry, what happened was.
This is insane. I was going to guess Jerry. This is crazy.
So, Jerry, what happened is I had written a blog post, and at the time I didn't have access to an image of the Beaton annual. And so instead of having a picture of the true first, the Beaton, what I did is I substituted a picture of one of Charles Doyle's illustrations, which, you know, technically isn't in the Beaton. It's in the first edition in book form. So technically it's wrong. And I just said first edition. I think I might have said book form, but I was in the post talking about the Beaton Christmas annual. And then that's what I had as a picture. And Jerry's like, you know, that's not in the Beaton. And I'm like, yes, I know. And so he helped me get a picture to supply and change it. And then from there, you know, we kind of developed a friendship. And he, at that point, it was this bizarre coincidence, because I had just gotten to know Jerry and we'd become friends. And right at that time, another man randomly showed up in the Vegas gallery, Richard Olkin. You laugh about that. I love these are the usual suspects.
Yeah. Well, I never would have suspected that Olkin would have been in Vegas of all places.
It was probably a conference. Yes, that's how most people end up in Vegas, is a conference. So he came to the gallery, and we were talking about Sherlock Holmes, of course, and he started talking about things like the BSI and the Speckled Bend. And I said, oh, you know, I just met this guy, Jerry Marglin. And things started just kind of falling into place. And Richard invited me to the second meeting of the Speckled Bend. It was sort of a special one they were doing in November. And I didn't know it at the time. That was the only one I actually could go to. So I went. It was right around the time of the Boston Antiquarian Book Fair. So I was in Boston at the time. And it was at the Houghton. It was really lovely. And I remember this weird realization I had of, wow, these are my people. Everyone here is so enthusiastic and nerdy. And the thing about Sherlockians, too, is that there tends to be this very expansive knowledge of Sherlock Holmes, but it tends to extend to literature generally. So, yes, we can have conversations about Woodhouse, and then we get talking about J.M. Barrie, and, you know, move on from there. And I had such a good time, and I was so impressed that I thought, oh, you know what, I'm going to look into this a little bit more. And that's when I started researching and pestering Jerry and Richard with questions. And the real turning point for me was Ronald Knox.
Uh-huh. You didn't meet him, did you?
No, that would be a real turning point. Yes. So I read his famous article. First of all, it was the 1911 speech, and then was published the next year. And my background with linguistics and classics, I had done a lot with language, with ancient Greek and Latin, and that included things that got into biblical exegesis, you know, the New Testament in Greek and such. And what he was doing there was just so brilliant to me and so entertaining, and I just fell in love with it. I was blown away by what he was doing. And I just kept moving. I went to Baring Gould's, you know, Sherlock Holmes of Baker Street, and I kept reading. And it all kind of fell into place really rapidly at that point. The quote I like to use, and I think I've actually said this to you, Scott, before, is there's this John Green quote where he says, I fell in love the way you fall asleep, slowly and then all at once. And that's exactly how it happened with Sherlock Holmes. It was always kind of there, and of course I love Sherlock Holmes and all of that. But then this all just went like dominoes, bam, 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 bam. And same thing with the Speckled Band. I was in New York during BSI weekend for the Winter Antique Show. Bowman Rare Books always has a setup at the New York Winter Antique Show in the Park Avenue Armory. And so while I was there, I went to some of the BSI festivities, and it was just – so impressed. There's this element of informed enthusiasm, I guess you could say. And I had this moment where I knew these are my people. This is something I want to continue in. And from then, I've always tried to make it to meetings and tried to get more involved. And really, in other words, we all have Jerry nitpicking my article to thank for this.
Amazing. Who would have thought that Jerry nitpicks anything?
Oh, I'm astonished. I'm
especially
astonished.
About illustrations.
Yeah. Now, Jerry, if there's somebody listening who hasn't listened to episode 16 yet, Jerry was, or still is, just the most amazing Sherlockian art collector. And he's very generous with his collection. He always invites people out. He loves to show it off. He puts out a Sherlockian holiday card every year from his gallery. He's just one of the best people to know. So take a listen to episode 16 in the Collector's Corner with Jerry Margolin if you haven't yet.
Yes, you really should. His collection is quite a joy to behold, I have to say.
Yes.
My favorite is the Ralph Steadman one. I just think that's such a great combination of Sherlock Holmes and Ralph Steadman.
Yeah, Jerry's a master of spotting those opportunities, or you know, even reaching out unsolicited to illustrators and artists. So very unique.
Yes. Very aggressive collector. And I say that as a good thing. I'm a rare book dealer. I like aggressive collectors.
Yes. So let's talk about your article in the Baker Street Journal from winter 2015.
Sure.
Called The Skeptic's Guide to Sherlock Holmes, 25 Facts About the Detective.
Mm-hmm.
And you say when we approach the stories, when we're students of Sherlock Holmes, you know, those of us who approach the stories with a more studious eye, we have to be skeptical. It's in our nature.
Yes. I think that's why we're drawn to Sherlock Holmes in the first place.
What do you mean?
It's a kindred spirit thing.
Do you mean that we're like Sherlock Holmes and that we're always trying to pick apart more? Or?
Well, we are, or what might be a better way to put it is that we want to be like Sherlock Holmes.
Oh.
I think one of the brilliant things about these stories is that we all want to be Sherlock Holmes. We're more likely, all of us, Watson. We don't really like to admit that, but Watson gives us this window into who we hope or want to be. That's my own. And, of course, like everything I say here, you know, everyone everyone's already said it before in Sherlock Holmes societies, but you have these conversations and I love getting in arguments with people about it, because that's the thing is we are all skeptics. We're all ready to nitpick any tiny argument. And I think we all enjoy a good argument.
So
am I only speaking for myself then?
No.
This is part of the fascination. I mean, it's having a debate. It's staking a claim. Right.
Yes.
And defending your territory and feeling confident about it for some reason, but then still being open to hearing a completely different side of the argument from something you may have never considered because your life experience simply does not encompass it.
Mm. Yes.
Well, also too, you know, it's very much like the reading experience. I mean, being a great reader means sort of developing a conversation between you and the storyteller. And the opportunity to continue that conversation with friends who've also looked at the same material can be a lot of fun. Hence, you know, our 101 episode now.
Yeah.
Oh, I very much agree with that, because I feel like one of the loneliest feelings is reading a book that you adore and having all of these new thoughts and having this dialogue back and forth with the author. But of course, the author isn't there to continue the dialogue. And then you want to talk to someone about it and no one else around you cares or is not interested in that author or something. And there's just something so lonely about having to hold that in or not being able to give some sort of outlet to that enthusiasm. And with Sherlock Holmes, that is not the case. You know, you read something or you read a new pastiche or you see, you know, a new episode of Sherlock or anything. And there are people who are ready and willing and excited to talk to you.
Yeah, that feeling is what drives some of us to make notes in margins. You know, who are we writing? Who are we writing these notes to? Maybe for ourselves at some future time, but... You know,
arguing with your future self.
Yeah. Or
I
arguing with the author who isn't there, you know, when you write the word blather in pencil in the margin of a book, you know, who are you communicating with?
Yeah, it's a little bit more fun when they can argue back,
yes,
though.
Yes.
And Bert, you've done that in more than just your autobiography, right?
No, it's just littered with commentary. What a bunch of fool scrap that is.
It seems to me like in that classic Twilight Zone episode where Burgess Meredith was down at the bank vault reading throughout his lunch break, and the nuclear bomb went off, and he came out, and he was the last person on Earth, and he toddled over to the library and found all these books, and the quote and the name of the episode was Time Enough at Last.
Mm-hmm.
The great irony was not that he stepped on his glasses and broke them, but it was that there was no one around with whom to share these great works with after the bomb went off.
Yeah.
Right. I think you have that initial shock, obviously, of the glasses.
Sure.
But you know, especially as an introvert, at first you think that's a wonderful thing. Oh, all the time I ever needed. There's never enough time to read. But eventually you do want to have a conversation because there's so many ideas that occur to you, and a lot of our ideas are worked out through speech.
Right.
We organize them into rational thought by language, and that really only works in a discussion with someone.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, poor old Burgess Meredith. I mean, apparently the writer, you know, somehow decided that all of the optical shops would have been melted to the ground. But why pick holes in these things? It sounds like an argument.
It does sound like an argument.
The last time we sang the praises of the Baker Street Journal was... Why, that was in episode 100. We spent the time delving into history to tell you all about the 100th issue of the BSJ. Do you recall the year the BSJ published its 100th issue? It was 1972. Now, if you couldn't answer that question, there are a few problems. One, you don't have a full collection of Baker Street journals at hand where you can reach up to the shelf and pull off a copy at your leisure. Or two, you do have a full collection of BSJs, but you're not so quick on your feet anymore and just gave up before I could answer for you. Or three, you probably didn't listen to the last episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, or if you did, you were blind drunk and you blacked out during the BSJ ad. Well, good news. We have the answer to your problems. Well, not the last one, that's personal. But what if you could have an entire run of the first 65 years of the Baker Street Journal at your fingertips, where you can get an answer with just a few keystrokes? The solution is the EBSJ, a complete set of the Baker Street Journal from its inception in 1946 through 2011 in a single DVD PDF format. Upload those to a cloud drive of your choice, and it's available on any mobile device. With 276 issues and more than 18,000 pages spanning all of the old series, the Christmas annuals, the new series through 2011, you'll have the most comprehensive set of material about Sherlock Holmes anytime you need it, anywhere you are. The EBSJ archive contains the full content of each issue, including text, illustrations, and advertisements. Isn't it time you put a full set of BSJs into your collection? For just a fraction of the cost of collecting the originals, it's the perfect thing. Get your EBSJ at BakerStreetJournal.com today. So, speaking of conversations about books, you've recently launched a podcast of your own called Biblioclast. Tell us a little bit about that. What's it about? How's it formatted?
Okay, so Biblioclast came about because my husband and I think one of the first things that brought us together was we both had an iconoclastic temperament, which is obvious in The Skeptic's Guide to Sherlock Holmes, where I'm taking such joy in dismantling the standard accounts. I think that there is something about enthusiasm can easily slide into dogmatism. And when you get very dogmatic about something, like, oh, Shakespeare was Shakespeare and he's a genius and he couldn't have ever written something terrible, then you run into problems where you stop being able to think about it critically, and then you're unable to make discoveries that you could otherwise make and continue the new thrill of surprises and expanding, you know, and continuing to have a conversation with that book or whatever it is. And so the Biblioclast idea is to look at something and not take it too seriously, look past the classic standard of this is one of the best books ever written. It's like we accept that. We know that. Now let's get underneath and talk about it from a real human perspective. What's so great about it that comes from the imperfections and the human elements?
So what's one of the books that you've began to piece apart like this that you've taken your literary hammer to?
Yes. Well, the first one we did was The Maltese Falcon. And in some ways, picking The Maltese Falcon was a statement in and of itself, because at Bowman, we focus so much on the grand tradition of Shakespeare and Hemingway and the like, that I wanted to represent something that was often more derided as a pulpy genre, right? Maltese Falcon is kind of borderline there because a lot of people do accept it, but I think it has a lot about the pulp tradition in it. There are things that Hammett does, stylistic traits that are just so pulpy, and I love that. But a lot of people can be snobby about it just on principle. So I wanted to get that out of the way. And for instance, I love The Maltese Falcon, but it probably has one of the worst opening paragraphs in literature. I mean, it's a terribly written paragraph. It's a physical description of Sam Spade, and the description doesn't even make sense. It talks about his face as a series of V's, and I'm like, I don't even know what that means. But I love it. It's fascinating because we talk about how it's characterization by physical description, etc. And so the idea is that we look at it and we acknowledge that maybe there's some things we just don't get. But that doesn't mean that we still don't love it. You can be critical of something and still really enjoy it. That's the duality I think we're trying to promote. Which Sherlockians definitely understand.
Yes, yes. So how does that project fit in with the other thing that you've got going on, this new book that's coming out called Printer's Error, Irreverent Stories from Book History?
Yes, they are very much in line with each other. That's the iconoclast, biblioclast thing. So Printer's Error, we take individual stories from the history of print and we try to sort of push past common assumptions about them. We have a chapter about Gutenberg, for example, where we reveal how it came to pass that scholars asserted Gutenberg as the printer of the first printed book in the West. In fact, was for hundreds of years, no one knew that it was Gutenberg. And even after that had been asserted, it took another 100 years on top of that for them to pinpoint which book was the true Gutenberg Bible. And so something that we take as fact in stone, you know, this is carved in marble, was unknown for most of the history of print. And these are narratives that develop over time. Mm. Like another one I think that's encapsulates the theme of the book pretty well is we were talking about Shakespeare before. Shakespeare's name with a shake with an E on the end and then spear, no versions of his name in manuscript form have that E at the end of shake. Mm. His name isn't actually spelled with that E. Mm. It was added by printers so that the K didn't overlap with the next S when you print. And so it was the printers who started spelling his name that way. It wasn't really his name at all. So everyone knows the bard as Shakespeare, and we've been spelling his name wrong for hundreds of years.
My goodness. All because of a kerning error.
Exactly. It's kerning. Mm-hmm.
Lord. Wow.
So it's just full of anecdotes like that that are sort of meant you to think again about the books that we've all loved and we've sort of written off as, we know how this works. We know the story of Shakespeare.
And what was the point where you started to – were these things you were encountering in your own research and working life and started jotting down and said to yourself, hey, wait a minute. Now I got 20 of these index cards. This could be a book.
Well, most of them, it's true. I did encounter them through one way or another, researching for Bowman or we talk about Huck Finn in there. I've sold first editions of Huck Finn. It did come partially from that for sure. But the theme – I think that just came from my temperament. I think that's just how I look at things is I look at it and I say, how can I destroy this? No, not destroy it, but you know what I mean. Like, how can I play with this a little bit?
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating.
So let's call it a playful nature rather than a destructive nature, huh?
Well, that's true. I mean, that is so aligned with the Sherlockian hobby that we all pursue. It's the idea of looking at something and saying, I wonder what's really going on here, you know?
Right. And that's what I'm saying. These are my people. I was so surprised that there was an entire group of like-minded souls who get together and just start nitpicking and doing word games and throwing in literary references. And it's one big party of the same tribe.
Mm. Nerds unite.
That's right.
So in your experience of selling rare books, what was the most expensive Sherlockian work that you sold?
Oh, well, me personally, I think that the most expensive is probably just a set of the Adventures and Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes in first edition in book form.
Those are nice.
Yeah, and they can be really beautiful if they're in well-preserved cloth, which of course is a difficult thing, and the hinges on those books tend to wear very easily. So, I mean, those, as
some,
far as...
Some-year-old Rebecca Romney was mishandling them, is that right?
No, never. Never. Someone was, yes. No, but in fact, this is an era where, publishers are trying to put out as many copies as possible, as quickly as possible. And, you know, you can make something fast, good, or cheap, but you can't make them all three. So these were fast and cheap. They weren't good. And as a result, the books don't tend to survive very well. They're poor quality materials, the paper, the binding, cloth, etc. And so it really is an exciting moment when you handle a first edition that just has cloth that seems to be glowing. So those, you know, they nice copies. They'll go for around 18,000 altogether, which in the Sherlockian, that's not even much for Sherlock Holmes material. We had at auction recently, there was that big event at Bonhams where there were, you know, manuscript, actual manuscripts, and then a leaf from Hound that right. You can get big, over $100,000. I haven't personally worked with it. I would love to, but no, I have not yet. Something to aspire to.
And, so, and the $500,000 book that's in your bio that we read, what was that?
I've sold a couple, actually. The one of them that was about – it was just under – it was $495 that I was in love with. It was a first edition of Newton's Principia Mathematica. Oh. And that's the book where he lays out the laws of motion and gravity. Really a moment where there was the world as we understood it before Newton and the world as we understood it after. Mm-hmm. Things just could not be visualized in the same way after. And it was also a private printing. There were only about 300 copies printed because Newton didn't want to publish, and his friend Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet pushed him to publish, and he, in fact, is the person who funded it. And so it's quite rare. And this copy was, oh, so beautiful. It was this contemporary full vellum with yap edges, which are these edges that kind of go over the foredge of the book. Oh, that was amazing. So that's also one of my favorite books that I've sold, in addition to be one of the more expensive ones.
Hmm. And did you find people as they traipsed through Las Vegas were perhaps more willing to part with larger sums of money than they otherwise might? Or when it comes to the mentality of a book collector, does it even matter?
Well, you know, I was, in fact, a number of us were a little concerned about that initially. We thought, what if someone comes in at night? Because we were open very late by rules of the casino/hotel. We had to be open until 11 o'clock on weeknights. It was crazy. And so we were afraid someone would come in at 10:30 and spend $10,000 and then come in the morning just looking aghast. this was our fear. It actually – I'm trying to think if that ever did happen. I'm trying to think if we had anyone who came back in a hungover state. In my experience, we did not. I don't think that we sold too many people. There were plenty of people who came in the next morning with a Bloody Mary and then made more purchases. But
hey, there you go.
Hey, lady, the last thing I remember is being here about 10 o'clock at night with about $500,000. And now I got this American Express receipt and a copy of a Principia Mathema something.
Yes. See, that was my worst fear. What happened? Because I don't want to sell a book like that to someone who isn't in love with it. So we were worried about that. But in fact, it really wasn't an issue. Most people assumed that because we were in Las Vegas, we must sell different types of books than what we sold in New York. And they assume it would be a different experience. And in fact, we sold mostly the same type of things that we have in our Philadelphia and New York locations. I think the only type of book we may have sold a little bit more of was James Bond books.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We did sell a lot of James Bond.
Yeah. So you go in and get the Principia Mathematica, and then you just, as an impulse buy, you throw in a couple of firsts of Ian Fleming, right?
That's right. They're good impulse buys. Oh, dear. Well, or it's what you get Casino Royale after you win at the casino.
Right there.
Oh, very good.
We did have that happen. There were a couple occasions, it was just utterly adorable, where there would be a couple or some people who'd come in and they'd find a book that they loved and they'd say, oh, you know, that's Jane Austen. I want that book. I cannot afford it, but I'm just dying. Will you let me hold it? We show it to them and it's this great experience. And then they're saying, oh, I can never afford it. And then 4 hours later, we see them rush back in with this look on their face. Like they're just, it's just frenetic, you know, and they're just, and they come in and they say, I wanted the tables.
I can't afford it.
That's great. Then they come in and buy. Yes, that did happen on occasion, which was fun.
You probably didn't see that as much in Philadelphia.
No. Not so much. Not so many cash purchases as well.
So how about the $50 book?
I sold a few of those.
What's a rare $50 book?
Oh, probably closer to, you know, a 21st century modern first book. Okay. Maybe a nice photo book or something. Things that, you know, it's funny. The older you get, there are certain books, you know, landmark books that you can kind of feel good about. Like if you buy a Shakespeare folio, you don't have to worry about Shakespeare going out of style. But some collectors are. I hope. Geez, that would be what would happen to the world if Shakespeare went out of style?
Well, if it was that Shakespeare guy.
That's right. All we have to do is change his name, and no one will listen to him. But one thing that people who collect, we call them like hypermodern, so really recent stuff, one thing that they tend to like about it is the idea of pitting their own taste against the market. So they buy first editions very cheap of the writers that they think are amazing. And then 50 years from now, were they right? Has that writer's star risen enough that the prices have risen as well? It's a lot more speculative, but some people, I think, get a kick out of that.
The thrill of the hunt and trying to see if you were right. I mean, it's not too dissimilar from the modern art market.
Yeah. I mean, for us, the art market can be very volatile, and the rare book world is like scared of that volatility. So we're always like, don't collect books for investments, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But people who do the hyper moderns, I think it's a game for them. I think that they're trying to pit their taste against, you know, critical taste and see if they were right.
Very cool. The day traders of the rare book industry.
Yeah, we'll see how that works out for them. I mean, the example that I always give, as you just cannot tell, is that, you know, a little over 100 years ago, there were two huge bestsellers that one of them everyone knows, which is Dracula. Dracula was a very good bestseller. Another that no one knows is Trilby. At the time, everyone read Trilby. In fact, that's what Trilby Hats comes from, the book Trilby. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge cultural phenomenon. And today, most people haven't even heard of it. So, you know, that's kind of what you're looking at, is even things that you think are major phenomenons today may not survive after 50 to 100 years. See how it ages.
Who wrote Trilby? I can't
remember. Du Maurier.
Yes.
You remember, Bert, the trouble with Trilbies?
Trouble with Trilbies. You mean with Trilby.
He keeps coming up on the show. I don't know. We got to get him on as a guest.
Shatner Echo. That's really fascinating. Yeah.
I just don't even know at this point. I feel like I've spent so much of my time just talking about things that make me happy that I think I wonder if I'm in this echo chamber.
No.
Where I think people are like, wow, that's great that you like that. Can you stop talking?
But there's so many. No, but there's so many cases, you know, like Trilby and Dracula as an example, where things that are popular and capture the public imagination, and at the same time, something else languishes. But 20 or 30 or 40 years later, usually after the author is dead, suddenly there's this awakening, you know, there's this match between, it wasn't right at the time, but for some reason it's right now.
Actually, yes, there's a really famous example of that, which is Moby Dick.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. When Moby Dick came out, it tanked. No one liked it. The critics didn't understand it. It didn't sell that well. And it was
They wanted another one of his travel books, right?
Yes, one of his sort of sea tales where he's going and living with cannibals and some South Sea island. He didn't do that. He got a lot more philosophical in Moby Dick. And it didn't do well. And it really was the beginning of his descent into obscurity. He was one of those authors that everyone thought it said in his obituary that, you know, everyone had already thought he'd died before he had. It was that type of thing. I know. That's what you want people to say in your obituary.
That's right.
And it wasn't until the 1920s with some scholarship that he was resurrected. And you start seeing these great editions of Moby Dick. And Moby Dick was not considered the great American novel until you start getting into the 1920s, 1930s.
But that's one of the frustrating experiences, you know, for people like us who are enthusiastic readers, to come across an author and a story that really speaks to you, that you love, that you share with other people, and you get a yawn, you know. You know, and you start to say to yourself, well, I don't know, maybe it was just me.
Yeah, that kind of loneliness I was talking about. But then you can have it on the other side where someone says, oh, you need to read this. And you're like, I didn't like it. Yeah. That's one of the most awkward moments when you feel bad that your taste not connected.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Thomas Pynchon, and I couldn't get anybody to. I remember I had a first edition of Gravity's Rainbow, and I remember just loving it and trying to connect people to it. And after they looked at the 500 pages and I read a couple of pages, they said, you know, I think I'll go get Root Canal instead.
So. Right. You know, with Pynchon, it's not even just the length. It's how he writes. It's a commitment on your part. I actually always loved Mason and Dixon. I had a client that turned me on to that particular book by Pynchon, which is more 18th century traveling scientists.
Right.
And it's the same thing where I'm the only one he can talk to about that book because everyone else, he's tried to get to read it and no one has finished it. So I understand we all have our own tastes. And for that reason, like I am very much a fan of saying, you know, enjoy what really speaks to you and don't worry about what you're supposed to like. If you didn't like Ulysses, that's fine. If you turns out you didn't like Hamlet, that's not the end of the world and you shouldn't feel bad about saying that. You should have some book that you love. I mean, but, you know, if you're not capable of love, period, then we've got some serious talking to do. But
yeah.
Well, I think it gets back to your point earlier about the physician that was collecting the books about skin diseases. It's about having a passion.
Yes. And
simply picking up on the excitement and emotion someone is getting from a certain topic, whether or not you share the interest in that topic, simply celebrating their passion and their excitement with them. I think that's what's the most important out of all this, because look, we're all going to have our own taste. We're all going to have our own predilections. Let's celebrate in what we have in common rather than picking apart what we don't.
Yeah. In fact, it's funny. One person I think who spent his career doing just that was Christopher Morley. I mean, he had this talent for exuberance,
yes,
where he enjoyed things so much, and he was able to communicate them in a way that other people started enjoying, even if they didn't agree, even if they weren't interested in whatever novel he was talking about. They still were entertained and liked to listen to him express his exuberance. I was always fascinated by his ability to do that. And, of course, that was another thread that eventually led me when I found out about the Baker Street Irregulars and everything, is I had, of course, read Morley's books on books, you know, Parnassus on Wheels and the Haunted Bookshop. And those, for a rare book dealer, those are required reading. So, and those are quotes that I always pull out. If I need a great quote about reading or books on books, I go to Christopher Morley.
Yeah. Oh, boy, I'm so happy to hear you mention Morley. I love it whenever we get to talk about something connected with him. And you're absolutely right. What was that streak of sentimentality that was remarked by his peers and by his brother, I think, after he passed away, that really set him apart, this enthusiasm. And it steered so much of his connections to other authors, his fondness for Robert Louis Stevenson and people like David Grayson It's that enthusiasm, you know, that's so distinctive about him, and it's missing in lots of people and authors today, unfortunately.
Well, I think it's like anything that people tend to be really good at, usually you have to work very hard to make something look that easy. And I think that Christopher Morley was exceptionally good at sharing his enthusiasm eloquently and in a way that was contagious. I really think that was a talent that other people could not do.
Well, that's very astute. Well, we appreciate your exuberance and your enthusiasm, Rebecca, and we thank you for being with us. Just a reminder, Rebecca Romney can be found at RebeccaRomney.com, and she does business with Honey and Wax Books. You can find them at HoneyandWaxBooks.com. Her book, Printer's Error, Irreverent Stories from Book History, will be published in early 2017 by HarperCollins. Stay on the lookout for that. And in the meantime, check out her podcast, Biblioclast, and subscribe to that as the perfect companion piece to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. How's that? Well, Rebecca, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You know, we just keep connecting with the most interesting and eloquent and articulate people. And this conversation is just another example of that. What a lot of fun.
I know. Well, you know, I've had,
keep talking to her for another hour.
I know, right? I every time I run into Rebecca, and it's usually at the BSI weekends, these are the kinds of conversations we have. And it's why, personally, I like to keep going back to events like this with people like Rebecca. These are the types of people Sherlockians tend to flock towards, the types of people that we are.
And if there was an award that the Baker Street Journal would give for the article of all time with the all-time best footnotes, I submit it's her winter 2015 article, which we just discussed on the interview. She has 21 of the most eloquent and beautifully written and interesting footnotes that I can remember ever seeing in my life.
Yeah, and usually footnotes are things that people skip over or just give a quick glance to say, okay, well, it's Ibid. I get it. I understand where the context is. But these almost have a flow of their own, don't they?
Yeah. And she says in her article, she comes to the end almost and says, while I'm still waiting for a compelling argument that Sherlock Holmes is even our detective's name, in the meantime, there are dozens of individual details of which we can be reasonably sure. And then she has a footnote, and the footnote is, no, please, really, I would love to read a compelling argument. Consider this a challenge.
The gauntlet has been thrown down.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder how many people picked up on that and perhaps viewed it as the challenge that she issued.
Friends, we're embarrassed. Our Sherlock Holmes brand product warehouse is full to the brim of facsimile first editions we intended to market as collectibles. But our distracted proofreader missed tiny spelling errors. It means great deals for you, as you can finally own original art by Frederick Doorstop, your own copy of Beecham's Christmas Annual. First editions personally signed by Arthur Conan Doyle, and so much more. They're the only rare book replicas that deliver the three C's. Covetous, collector, confusion! Confusion! Act now to own your original illustration by Sidney Puget. Hey, I like the sound of that. At your Sherlock Holmes brand dealer today!
Well, in the meantime, if you have any response to what's been going on here, any kind of visceral reaction, any kind of exuberance of your own, please get on over to ihearofsherlock.com and express it accordingly. Mm-hmm. Send us an email, comment at ihearofsherlock.com. Go on to this very episode's show notes at ihose.co/ihose101 and leave a comment in the comment section of the post. Of course, that telephone.
Yes, call us, please. Yes. Please. 774-221 read 7-3-2-3.
There you go. It's still there.
Remember my rotary dial. Yeah.
You have to take that smartphone off of your ear to look at it to determine where those letters and numbers are now.
I can't. There's a Japanese elf on it.
Good Lord.
Ow.
I got to say ow.
Ow.
And of course, as you continue to do, we encourage you to go over to Patreon.
Oh, yes, please.
/iHearofSherlock. Join people like Mary Miller and become a patron of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. We also should note that many of you were very kind in your remarks and congratulatory notes and whatnot around our 100th episode. As we get more of those in, we will share some relevant ones as appropriate. But we also do have a fun show coming up next in episode 102, where we have some audio excerpts from The Misadventures of Sherlock Holmes, the triennial conference that the Norwegian explorers put together in Minneapolis, thanks to our intrepid street reporter, Steve Mason. So stay tuned for that.
Well, I guess there's nothing left to say, is there?
Well, there are a couple things left to say, and one of them is, I'm Scott Monty.
I knew you were going to say that. And I'm not. I'm Burt Wolder.
And this is the part where we say,
the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
Anywhere you go to a Sherlockian society, everyone's so welcoming and you can be a complete stranger and immediately, you know, you connect with people. So that's the thing is I had this accidental serendipitous entree into it, kind of like my entry into the rare book world, and you start running with it because it was the right thing.
Yeah.
When you look ahead, are you optimistic when you look at publishing today about print runs, about book design, about writers, about the fact that we're in an environment where there aren't any more handwritten or hand-typed manuscripts and things are becoming more electronic?
You know, this is a good question because I think in some ways the answer is more a reflection on you than any accurate prediction of the future. But for me, one thing that I've noticed is that this change into a more dominant digital realm has – brought a new attention to analog, to paper books and print and that type of thing. And I think the reason why is because when that's what a book looked like, was just a print book, we took it for granted. We saw right past it. We didn't think about it. And now that we can see a difference and see that there are pros and cons to each, either, you know, I confess I read books even on my phone. I do use a Kindle, but I also use print books. There are things that you can get out of each of them, and it forces you to think about books differently. And I think that there are going to be a lot of fruitful results of that, because book designers do have to consider that. I think I read an article about how a lot of yellow book covers are starting to appear because they look a lot better online when you're shopping, like on Amazon or something. Huh. Right? And so I think that people are reacting, but I don't think it's a doomsday reaction scenario. I don't think people are stopping reading. In fact, a lot of use on the internet is reading. So certainly there's a reading culture. A lot of millennials and things do read, despite maybe reputations. And I see, in fact, a sort of energy. People are getting energized by the fact that there's this new awareness. And I think it's really exciting. Keep in mind that for most of the history of print, print runs were tiny. Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, one of the greatest works ever published, really. 1776, it was published in an edition of 750 copies. The Federalist Papers was published in book form in an edition of 500 copies, perhaps. Mm. For most of the history of print, print runs were average 1,000 copies or less. And these days, for a big book, I mean, if you had a biography coming out by someone famous, you can get print runs up to like a million copies. Hmm. And then you're running into like that's actually a problem for the collecting market, because it's not rare at all, unless maybe it's inscribed to, you know, major association or something. Hmm. And so even if we change in scarcity and go back to print runs that are quite small, that will just be normal for the history of print. Hmm. And in fact, I'm really interested to see how people, maybe backlash isn't the right word, but react to this new interaction between our reading and the digital world and our inheritance of print.